Hi, Mike. Thank you. And hello to everyone. And thank you, too, for joining us tonight for yet another episode of Broken Bread, brought to you by Mike Coles from newliferadio.co.uk and myself, Ron Bailey, from BibleBase.com. And you're joining us as we're in the midst of studies following up on the book that I wrote some time ago called The Better Covenant, and we're doing what we call a study guide. And this is how far we've got so far. We've actually got as far as tonight's episode is episode 26. And there's quite a lot in this, so if you want to kind of follow it up, you can access it in all kinds of ways. You can access it on our website. You can access it on Mike Coles' website. You can access it through a podcast, and that are available, an HTML, what's known as a dynamic HTML file, or a PDF file. So you can follow these through and check out the verses as you come to them. Okay, are you ready? Okay, well, we'll make a start. We'll start with the introduction. Last time we were together, we introduced the three prophets whose ministry spanned more than 100 years. And although they never met and probably knew little of each other's ministry, their ministry is along the same lines. The language and the imagery is often different, but their theme is one. They're all looking past the current coming judgment to something new. Isaiah is the earliest of these men to bring a message that people are not to think about the old ways in which God had worked in the past. So let's have just a brief look, just to get the flavour of some of the things that come through these three prophets. He's the earliest of them then, which is Isaiah, and he was ministering from about 740 years before Christ to 700 years before Christ, about 40 years plus. This is from Isaiah chapter 42 and verse 9, and he says this: "Behold, the former things are come to pass." That means they've happened. The things that were going to happen have happened. "And new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them." So the past is past in that sense. And now he says, "I got some new things to say. New things do I declare." So if we go to Isaiah 43, verse 18 to 19, we find that he's along the same line still. And there he says, "Remember ye not the former things, neither consider the things of old. Behold, I will do a new thing. Now it shall spring forth. Shall ye not know it? Won't you recognize it? I will even make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert." He's beginning to pick up images from the old Exodus, which was a way through the wilderness. They had no rivers in the desert, but they had a rock which followed them, which supplied them with all that they required to drink. Okay, let's go on to Isaiah 48. And verse 6, and now again he says, you'll see what a familiar theme this is. "Thou hast heard it. Behold all this, and will ye not declare it? I have showed thee new things from this time, even hidden things." That's a revelation. When there are things that have been hidden, and you haven't seen them before, and then God unveils them or reveals them to you, that's a revelation. "I have showed thee new things from this time, even hidden things, which thou hast not known." In all these verses, Isaiah is using the language of the Exodus to describe the future, but is making it clear that what God is planning is not simply a kind of a rehash or a repeat of that escape from captivity in Egypt. God, he says, and he says it often enough for it to kind of embed itself in our minds, God is going to do a new thing. And Isaiah uses another word which indicates that this is not a repair or just an addition to something, but a new creation. In Isaiah chapter 65, verses 17 and 18, he says this, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered, nor come to mind. Be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy." We've said before that that is a Hebrew word which means to create, and God is only ever the one who is the subject of that verb. In other words, it's always God who creates, and very often it's God who creates, if you like, out of nothingness. And I think it was last time we were together that I mentioned that significantly create is used quite often after a destruction of some kind. So God wipes the deck clear, and then he creates something brand new. And we will see how Paul takes up this theme of a new creation and a new Jerusalem later. So that's just a brief introduction to Isaiah and some of his themes. Now let's see how Jeremiah handles those things. Jeremiah is coming 100 years later. That's from about 640 BC to about 587 BC. He's coming 100 years later and is essentially saying the same thing, but using a different vocabulary, or shall we say, a different palette. This is Jeremiah 31, verses 31 to 32, and it's the heart of an important section, but it's one that's known and loved by many of us. This is it. He says, "Behold, the days come, says Jehovah, that I will make a new covenant." Notice this word "new" coming through. Isaiah says a new thing. Jeremiah says a new covenant. "Behold, the days come, says Jehovah, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt." I'm tempted to kind of go into these with a little bit more detail, but we've got a lot of ground to cover tonight, so I'll press on. "I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which, my covenant, they break, although I was a husband to them, says Jehovah. Now, this is an especially important prophecy, and we shall return to it later. But in passing, we should notice that it was addressed to whom? Well, it was addressed to both of the separate nations. "Behold, the days come, says Jehovah, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." Okay, so it was addressed to both of the separate nations, the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. Do you remember the distinction between those two? Well, the house of Israel was the northern kingdom of 10.5 tribes, and it was called Israel. And it was it had split off from the united monarchy of David and Solomon and the son, Rehoboam. But it wasn't just an activity of men that did that. It was God who tore away from Rehoboam because of his inadequacy, because of his refusal, really, to do what God wanted him to do. He tore off 10.5 tribes and gave them into the hands of a man named Rehoboam. And Rehoboam became the legitimate God-ordained king of Israel. Okay, so that's the northern kingdom. The house of Judah is just what's left. That's all. So he speaks, he addresses what he's saying to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah, and declares that God is going to make a new covenant. And using the same pattern of contrast that we've just seen in Isaiah, he says, "Not according to the covenant that I made with your fathers." In other words, don't look into the past for your clues as to how to interpret the future, because this future is going to be a new thing. It's going to be a creation, not a modification, not an alteration, not an addition, not an amendment. It's going to be a new creation. Okay. So he's using the same pattern of contrast that we've seen in Isaiah, and he says, not according to the covenant that I made with your fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. So Isaiah's new thing was not to be compared to the former days. And now Jeremiah says the new covenant, essentially, is not to be compared to the old Sinai covenant. Okay, let's move on to Ezekiel. Ezekiel is from about 593 to 570 BC. When it's Ezekiel's turn to prophesy, he declares the same truths but uses yet another different vocabulary, another colour on the artist's palette. This is Ezekiel 36, and I'm going to talk about Ezekiel 36 and what follows it shortly. Ezekiel 36 and verse 26. A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you. And I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you a heart of flesh. He says much more than this, but for the time being, and at the risk of repetition, we will just gather those key points together. The old ways, the old covenant, the old heart were all to be left behind. And in their place, not alongside, in their place, there would be a new thing, a new covenant, a new heart. This is not an addition, but a replacement. God declares he will take away the stony heart and give a heart of flesh. All three prophets predict a judgment followed by something new that cannot be compared to what has gone before. Later, the writer to the Hebrews writes that God takes away the first, that he may establish the second. It really is crucial to our understanding of what the new covenant is all about, to understand that phrase. God takes away the first, that he may establish the second. This is not a modification. This is not an alteration. It's not an addition. This is a replacement. This is a replacement covenant. He takes away the first, that he may establish the second. So let's have a look then at who it is who are the recipients of these blessings that are promised. God is promising wonderful things. He's promising a new thing. He's promising a new covenant. He's promising a new heart. Who is he promising these things to? Who are going to be the recipients of these promised blessings? At first glance, it seems obvious, the house of Israel and the house of Judah. After all, are they not the nations to whom Jeremiah addressed his prophecy? Yes, they are. He needed to gain the attention of the house of Israel, now in captivity, and the house of Judah, also now in captivity. But when he has that attention, he makes a significant statement. So let's just remind ourselves of how that begins. And he says, so if we extend our quotation of Jeremiah, that just single verse we read, Jeremiah 31:31, and we stretch it to verse 33, listen to this in its proper setting. Behold, this is the first bit that we read. Behold, the days come, says Jehovah, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was a husband unto them, says Jehovah. And then unto the next verses. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Jehovah. I will put my law in their inward parts, and in their heart will I write it, and will be their God, and they shall be my people. Now, there are two puzzles questions that might arise if you think about this. The first is that God had brought the people group, the families of the patriarchs from Egypt to himself at Sinai, and had entered into a covenant with them so that he could be their God and they would be his people. That was the whole purpose of the covenant. They would be his and he would be theirs. This is a mutual and exclusive covenant between two parties, Jehovah, Israel's God, and the people of Israel themselves, who become from Sinai God's covenant people. But look at this. He says here, "This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days," says Jehovah. "I will put my law in their inward parts, and in their heart will I write it. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people." Just a minute. Aren't they already his people? Isn't he already their God? Well, yes, in that covenant, but this is a new covenant. This isn't a reaffirmation of the old covenant. This is a new covenant. If we just dig a little bit deeper, verse 31 tells us that God is going to make a new covenant with both the house of Judah and the house of Israel. In other words, these two ancient and separate nations. However, in verse 33, he describes the nature of the covenant that he is going to make with the house of Israel, and he makes no mention of the house of Judah. What has happened to the house of Judah, previously mentioned in verse 31? Is this new covenant with both or only one? Let me read you these verses again, and I'll try and emphasize the point I'm making. It begins by this: "I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Jacob." But then later on, just a verse or two later on, when he actually says, "This is the covenant that I will make," he says, "This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel." Now, previously he had said, "I will make a covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." Now he says, "This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel." Now, did he stumble, misread his lines? Have the translations got it wrong? No, this is exactly what it says. And when you get a sort of a discrepancy like this, it's always worth digging into it, because quite often there is some deep spiritual significance to the way that this is happening here. So, initially, he is speaking to the house of Israel, the house of Judah, but he says, "This is the covenant that I will make," and then he only refers to the house of Israel. So, what's happened? So, there's the question. Verse 31 tells us that God is going to make a new covenant with both the house of Judah and the house of Israel. In other words, with these two ancient and separate nations. However, in verse 33, he describes the nature of the covenant that he's going to make with the house of Israel, and makes no mention of the house of Judah. So, where's the house of Judah gone? This is part of the answer. In the previous chapter, chapter 13, God declares that he will bring both separate nations back from captivity. This is Jeremiah 30 now, verses 1 to 3. "The word that came to Jeremiah from Jehovah, saying, 'Thus speaks Jehovah, the God of Israel.'" That's his great title, Israel's God, Jehovah. "Write thee all the words that I have spoken unto thee in a book. For lo, the days come, says Jehovah, that I will turn again the captivity of my people Israel and Judah." Okay, so there's going to be a deliverance from the captivity for the people of Israel and the people of Judah, says Jehovah. "And I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it." It'll be helpful, perhaps, with this constant use of the word Israel, if we remind ourselves that God ordained and confirmed the separation between the house of Israel and the house of Judah during the reign of Rehoboam, the grandson of David. And God owned Israel and he owned Judah. He continued to use the language of the scriptures, to rise up early and send them prophets as messengers to both kingdoms. God didn't cut off the northern kingdom. He continued to fulfill his word to them and sent words to them which were intended to trigger their repentance. The northern kingdom of Israel in the land is known as Samaria, and that had been stripped of its inhabitants. Only a trickle of the northern tribes had relocated, going south to the kingdom of Judah, where they could be under a more godly ministry of that style. It was patchy, to say the least. In fact, there's a very graphic little comment that Isaiah makes in chapter 17 and verse 6 when he talks about this judgment that God is bringing and the land of Israel will be stripped of its inhabitants. And he says, "There shall be left therein gleanings, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uttermost bough, four or five in the outermost branches of a fruitful tree," says Jehovah, the God of Israel. That's God saying that only a very small proportion of the people of Israel did actually trickle southwards and become part of the history of the South. We'll come to that in a little while. So we'll find a secret here as to what's happening in what I'm calling an almost forgotten miracle. You may be one of those who hasn't forgotten this miracle, but it's not often referred to. I don't think I've ever heard it referred to, and I've listened to a fair bit of preaching over my days. So what is Ezekiel's forgotten miracle? Well, Ezekiel's prophecy includes a wonderful promise of a new heart. That's Ezekiel chapter 36, 22 to 32. And we'll read it because although it's a long one, it's an important one. "Therefore say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord Jehovah, I do not this for your sake." Remember that phrase. "I do not this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations whither you went." He'll repeat that at the end of this little section. "And I will sanctify my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you have profaned in the midst of them. And the nations shall know that I am Jehovah, says the Lord Jehovah, when I shall be sanctified in you before their eyes. For I will take you from among the nations, and gather you out of all the countries, and will bring you into your own land. And I will sprinkle clean water upon you, and ye shall be clean. From all your filthiness and from all your idols will I cleanse you. A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you. And I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you, and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep mine ordinances and do them. And you shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers, and ye shall be my people, and I will be your God. And I will save you from all your uncleannesses. And I will call for the grain, and will multiply it, and lay no famine upon you. And I will multiply the fruit of the tree, and the increase of the field, that ye may receive no more the reproach of famine among the nations. Then shall ye remember your evil ways, and your doings that were not good. And you shall loathe yourselves in your own sight for your iniquities and for your abominations. Nor for your sake," here's the repeat, "do I this, says the Lord Jehovah, be it known unto you, be ashamed and confounded for your ways, O house of Israel." So chapter 36 has this wonderful promise of the new heart, and we won't go into that now because that joy lies ahead of us. And of course, Ezekiel 36 flows into Ezekiel 37. So chapter 37 and verse 1 has an account of two sticks. Yes, that's what I said, two sticks. The records found in Ezekiel 37 flowing straight from Ezekiel 36. And we find two prophetic revelations here. First of all, there's the one Ezekiel 37 verses 1 to 14, and it's the resurrection from the battlefield of Israel's dead and a return to the land of Israel. Ezekiel 37 verse 11, this prophecy is addressed to the house of Israel, and he says, "This he said unto me, O son of man, these bones," what is all this about? What is the interpretation? Well, here's God's interpretation. "These bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried up and our hope is lost. We are clean cut off. Therefore prophesy and say unto them, thus saith the Lord, Jehovah, behold, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves, O my people, and I will bring you into the land of Israel. Now, this is directed toward the house of Israel. There's no mention of Judah here in this prophecy. And then we come to Ezekiel 37, where you get the second two revelations and two sticks. The prophet now is instructed to take two sticks to enact dynamically a prophecy. This is Ezekiel 37, verse 16. He says, "And thou, son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it, for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions." So the first stick is inscribed with the names for Judah. So the prophet is instructed to take two sticks to enact a dynamic prophecy. Ezekiel 37, verse 16, "And thou, son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it, for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it, for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions." So the first stick is inscribed with the words, "For Judah and the house of Israel." This is the southern nation state of Israel. The second stick is inscribed with the words, "For Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel." This is the northern nation state of Israel. So the first one was the nation state of Judah in the south. Now we've got the northern nation state of Israel. The second state is inscribed with the words, "For Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of companions." Now, this is where we need to kind of fit this all together, and we discover throughout these prophecies and throughout the history of these days, the northern kingdom, that's the one that has the label of Israel on it, "For Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions." The northern stick is not only described in the Bible as the house of Israel, but also as Ephraim, and as Joseph, and as Rachel, and as Samaria. Why so many labels? Its first king, Jeroboam I, was from the family of Ephraim. So this is known as Ephraim. And Ephraim was its largest tribe or clan. Ephraim, in turn, was one of the sons of Joseph. So this is Joseph, the stick of Ephraim. And Joseph was the son of Rachel. That doesn't come here, but it comes elsewhere. Rachel weeping for his children and not being comforted. And it's also called Samaria after the name of its capital city. So Ezekiel has two sticks, two separate sticks. Then he receives further instructions. And here they are in Ezekiel 38, 17 to 20. "And join them for thee one to another into one stick, that they may become one in thy hand." Now watch what this. This is in Ezekiel's hand. He's got the two sticks in his hands and he puts them together that they may become one in Ezekiel's hand. "And when the children of Israel, the children of thy people, shall speak unto thee, saying, Wilt thou not show us what thou meanest by this? Say unto them," here's the interpretation, "Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph." Now, which nation is that? Yeah, that's right. That's the northern kingdom, "which is in the hand of Ephraim and the tribes of Israel, his companions. And I will put them with it, even with the stick of Judah," that's the south, "and make them one stick, and they shall be one in my hand." Did you notice this? Ezekiel is to do something with his hand as a dynamic prophecy and miracle of the fact that they shall become one in God's hand. "And the sticks whereon thou writest shall be in thy hand before their eyes." It seems a miracle would take place in the hand of Ezekiel, who is referred to as the Son of Man. Did you notice that? Over 30 times in the prophecy of Ezekiel. God refers to Ezekiel as son of man. Can't help but bring the son of man to mind. And you'll see prophetically, Ezekiel was not just a prophet. He was in himself a prophecy. And he was acting out many of the things that the Lord Jesus would do in the reality of his time upon the earth. I wonder sometimes if Ezekiel's dynamic prophecy brought a much older Bible verse to mind from Genesis. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. You see, Bible truths are often deeply laid, layer upon layer. And as you dig down, you find amazing truths that are linked together. I want us to look at a prophecy that comes into Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 21, which has to do with these two separate nations becoming one nation under one king. Then the significance of the miracle was spelled out by God clearly for any who were puzzled by everything that had been said. Here's Ezekiel 37, verses 21 and 22. And say unto them, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the nations whither they are gone, and will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all. And they shall be no longer two nations, neither shall they be divided into kingdoms any more at all. God was going to reunite the nation. They will be one in my hand. They will become one nation again, but only under one king. You know, they only ever became one nation under one king. It was only when the different tribes submitted to David that they became one. The king united the nation in his person. It wasn't that they were kind of signing up to regulations or a contract or some different sort of a covenant. It was that they came to David and they came under David's authority. And as they came under David's authority, they were one nation for the first time properly. They functioned as one nation. And it began to get a little bit scrappy towards the end of David's reign, and it went downhill pretty quickly through Solomon's reign, and it crashed and burned in the reign of Rehoboam. But they were one once under one king. God was going to reunite the nation. There'll be one king in my hand. They'll become one nation again under one king. It would no longer be the house of Israel and the house of Judah, but simply, as Jeremiah expressed it, the house of Israel. These promises are for the house of Judah and the house of Israel, but the covenant that God would make would reunite them. They would become a new Israel as a result of a new thing, a new covenant, a new people. They would become people of one heart, and that's the earlier passage from Ezekiel chapter 11. You remember, we've been reading this passage in Jeremiah where God speaks about one heart, and in Ezekiel where he speaks about having sort of a new heart. But here in Ezekiel he says, I will give them one heart. You see, the one heart that God gives us unites us to those who are of the one heart. So when we come under the authority of the Son of Man, when we come under the authority of the one who is the King, everything is brought together as one under him. Not because they've agreed all their doctrinal issues or because they've made some promises or there's been some deal, but because they've come together under God. Two separate nations would be reconstituted as a single nation, a single entity. You see, covenants can do that. It's going to be a new creation. God, who alone can better create, was committed to the project. But I want to pass on to you a reminder from Israel from Isaiah. We do need to remind ourselves of what I'm calling the Isaiah factor. This is Isaiah chapter 10, verses 21 to 22. And Isaiah says this. Notice the repetition of the word remnant. A remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them shall return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. And this is Isaiah 11 and verse 11. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people that shall remain from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathros and from Cush and from Elam and from Shinar and from Hamath and from the islands of the sea. In Isaiah 11 and verse 16, and there shall be a highway for the remnant of his people that shall remain from Assyria, like as there was for Israel in the day he came up out of the land of Egypt. So this return, then, would not be the return of every single individual from the house of Israel, or every single individual who returned from the house of Judah, but a remnant from both houses. Do you remember we said this a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, and we talked about the remnant, that many of these people would go into obscurity, they would vanish into the other nations and be lost to history anyway. The return would not be every single individual from the house of Israel and not every single individual from the house of Judah, but a remnant from both houses. When the apparent outworking of these wonderful promises began to take place, it was indeed a remnant that returned, a tiny remnant. When the people came back during the times of Ezra and Nehemiah from Babylon, that was a remnant. In fact, it was the people who'd been taken were a remnant of a remnant. And even the people who were in Babylon, they didn't all return, only a remnant of that remnant returned. I calculated some time ago, it's a bit rough and ready, but out of an original population of perhaps about 7 million or less, less than 50,000 would return as a remnant. But when the remnant returned in the time of Ezra, he simply just called it Israel. The different distinctions of the house of Israel and the house of Judah are gone now. It's just Israel. And Ezra records that all Israel was settled back in their cities. But Israel now is actually the remnant of Israel. I did these calculations a long time ago, so if they're wrong, you can tell me. Slightly more than a half of 1% returned as the remnant to become the start of a new nation. The remnant was tiny. But this remnant was enough and was now all Israel. This people could become the carrier of the promises given to God's covenant people. In the early prophecies of Ezekiel, we read of this promise to reunite the people under one king. But this time, the way that Ezekiel expresses it is breathtaking. This is Ezekiel 34:22-24. Listen to this. We're going to remind ourselves as we read this that David has actually been dead for almost 400 years when this prophecy comes to Ezekiel. So here it is. Therefore I will save my flock, and they shall no more be a prey, and I will judge between sheep and sheep, and I will set up one shepherd over them. Now this is the familiar language of Isaiah, isn't it? That they were going to be one people, and there would be one king over them. I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them. Even my servant David, he shall feed them, he shall be their shepherd. And I, Jehovah, will be their God, and my servant David, prince among them. I, Jehovah, have spoken it. Now, let me remind ourselves again. David has been dead and buried for almost 400 years when God gave this prophecy to Ezekiel. So what does this prophecy mean? There's a name in here, David. He's going to be one shepherd. He's going to be God's shepherd. He's going to be the servant of Jehovah. Who is this? Well, did it just mean some kind of return to the family of David, the Davidic dynasty, or did it mean that which was far beyond their comprehension at this time? The scene was being set for the fulfillment of these promises that would be more complete than anything they could imagine. Surely, Christ had these words and colours in his mind some 500 years later when he declared himself to be the Good Shepherd. Listen how he's using the language of Ezekiel here. And other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. Now, the New King James Version does something here which is very helpful in that it corrects the King James Version. Because in the King James Version, it will say something like this: other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one fold and one shepherd. That isn't what it says. It's very specific. You see, a fold is an enclosed company. But Jesus here goes beyond the fold, which was Israel, and he begins to speak of one flock. There were many folds. Other sheep I have which are not of this fold, the implication being that there are other folds, or at least one other fold. Other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. He is consciously using the language, the colours of Ezekiel. The new covenant would reconstitute the separated peoples of Israel and Judah into a new Israel, and over that one flock, David's greatest son would reign. But who are the other sheep that will also find their way and their place in this new setting and become part of one new flock? Now, can you keep a secret? So can God, and he kept it for hundreds of years. And I'll keep it, not for hundreds of years. Let me summarize where we've got to. In this chapter, the Better Covenant, chapter 10, it is entitled A New Start in the book, we revisited the new thing, the new covenant, the new heart themes of the prophets who spoke of the restoration. And we began to see that this is not just a reclamation or a salvage attempt, but that out of this Syrian Babylonian exile, something quite new would begin to come to birth. We saw that a new Israel would be constituted with a different covenant. And we saw that Christ had these prophecies in mind in some of his most famous, most wonderful, most tender New Testament sayings. We also asked, but did not answer, who Christ's other sheep must be. We'll come to a close there. There's a lot in this. Think about these prophecies. These prophecies are long and they're intricate in the way that they link together. And I've just picked out some samples, but I would recommend, if you've not done it before, that you get one of the hard copies of this, either as the HTML or the PDF, and follow through these references and look at them and see how wonderfully God's truth was embedded in particularly these three great prophets and the way that they would be fulfilled in a measure that not even they could have guessed. Greater than Solomon, greater than David, who would come to be God's good shepherd, the one who would lay down his life for the sheep. Well, thank you again for your company with us for this session. we do enjoy knowing that you're there listening, and we enjoy any comments you have for us. So we'll stop there, and God willing, we trust to have your company again next week, next day, same time. We'll see you. God bless you.